All right. So I want to put what I'm going to say in a slightly bigger context than perhaps the title suggests. And that's really the question of the relation between quantum computation and entanglement. Is entanglement somehow essential for the power of quantum computers? And if I was giving a different talk, I'd start off with 30 minutes of doing the following. I would show you something like the following. If we imagine that we want to use resources in physical systems, resources like energy, angular momentum, size of systems, efficient resources, use of resources other than time, then you can make a kind of semi-classical argument that this implies that your computer must be made of parts. That's so you can represent information efficiently without wasting some resource like energy or position size of your machine exponentially. And that's a physicist's argument, so it's my argument. And it's certainly not a mathematical proof, but it's not a bad argument. So what that means is that if you accept that, then your computer must be made of parts. That is, it has to have a tensor product structure, and you can make that more precise. That is, how the number of parts has to scale with problem size. And then you can use an argument due to Richard Josa and Noah Linden to say the following, that if there, with that computer made of parts, if there's no efficient, realistic simulation of some computation, that is, if your quantum computer is actually doing something useful, then this implies a thing that's roughly speaking global entanglement among the parts, although the actual correct statement is that entanglement cannot be restricted to blocks of fixed size. And that's blocks of parts from the first part of the argument. And fixed size means independent of problem size. So somehow that says something like global entanglement is essential for quantum computation. It's essential in a different way than entanglement is essential for something like entanglement-based key distribution or quantum teleportation, because you notice there's nothing about locality in here. I will say something about locality as I go along in an attempt to relate it to this, but there's nothing about locality in here. So if entanglement is essential for quantum computation, it appears not to have something to do with locality. It has to do with these two words, efficient and realistic. So if you believe that, then you'd really like the following to be true. Here's a big circle that is processes that make globally entangled quantum states. And here's a big circle of processes that have no efficient, realistic description. And you'd like these circles to coincide, so that if there's no efficient realistic description, it means you made some global entanglement. And if there's global entanglement, there's no efficient realistic description. But when you try to put these two circles together, they don't exactly fit, even given what we know now. And what I'm talking about is really the cracks between these two circles. And one of those cracks is mixed state quantum computation. Where it might appear, although we don't really know, that you can get the power of quantum computation, that is, no efficient realistic description, without global entanglement. What goes wrong with my argument over there? Well, if you try to push through the Josa-Linda argument, that step doesn't follow. All that follows is the computer can't be in a product state, in a product state of blocks of fixed size, and that doesn't mean that there's entanglement, because of the difference between entanglement and separability. So the idea is you might get the power of quantum computation just from separable states that have a complicated description. So we have a little program to think about this, and if you're interested in that, you should see Animesh Datta's poster, where we look at the so-called power of one qubit model and actually find some entanglement. And it is global entanglement. So that supports the idea that maybe at that end, entanglement is essential even for mixed state quantum computation. The other end of this says a situation where you get all the global entanglement you want. Actually, I did want to say that carefully. We'll say it carefully in a minute. Using so-called Clifford circuits, they will make lots of entanglement, but you will be able to simulate them efficiently. And that's what I'm going to be talking about. And I use lots there deliberately, because I've said all kinds of entanglement and all sorts of entanglement. You might think I was using a technical word, but nobody thinks lots. It's a technical word. So you have lots of entanglement by some measure. I'm not making any distinction here, although I realize there could be a distinction. I should say that everything on these three blackboards, I'm not being very careful at all. All right, so this is what we're going to be thinking about. So let me just tell for the, let me just summarize for those of you who aren't familiar with it, what I'm talking about. And I should start keeping track of my time. Yep. All right, so the fact that you can make lots of entanglement and still have an efficient simulation of the creation of that entanglement is contained in a thing called the Gottesman-Knill theorem. And sometimes I will call those, instead of calling the situation Clifford circuits, I might be inclined to call it Gottesman-Knill circuits or GK circuits. They're all the same thing. So what are the rules here? The rules are the following. Got n qubits. You start in a standard state. And that standard state is just, let's say, all the qubits in the computational basis state, 0. You have a certain number of allowed gates you can perform. And you allow the Hadamard gate, the gate that I'm going to call S, which is a 90-degree rotation about the z-axis, and the c-naught, and you get for free, of course, everything you can create from those, amongst which are 180-degree rotations about the x, y, and z-axes, that is the Pauli operators, x, y, and z. You can get the c-phase, which I'll talk about a little bit later, but all we need to put in at the start is hs and c-naught. That's only short of a universal gate set by the 45-degree rotation about the z-axis. So you might think, oh, this is going to do something pretty good. But it does make lots of entanglement, lots in the technical sense that I just discussed. But it doesn't make, but all such circuits can be efficiently simulated. Let's see, what else do I need? I need measurements. Well, the measurements I'm going to allow are measurements in the z basis. And since I've got all of these rotations about the x, y, and z axes, if I've got z measurements, I might as well allow x and y ones as well. So I allow you to go in at some point and measure any qubit along one of the Cartesian axes. All right. So the statement is, I think I've got all the assumptions in there. And the statement is that any such circuit can be efficiently simulated. And it's a result of Aaronson and Gottesman that you can be efficiently simulated with order n squared resources, where n is the number of qubits. So the next thing I'm going to say is just, you know, roughly speaking, how that simulation is done. Many of you will be familiar with this, but some of you won't, so it's perhaps useful to do. And the way you do this is in terms of a thing called stabilizer formalism, which is something that lies at the heart of quantum error correction, as formulated by Dan Gottesman. And so learning about it is a good thing, even if you aren't interested at all in what I'm saying about it. So let's see what elements of the stabilizer formalism do we need. Well, let's start with the Pauli group. The Pauli group for n qubits is just all the products of Pauli's, one for each qubit, plus the identity. So take a Pauli for each one, and you can multiply that out in front to make it a group. You've got to close it under four phases, plus or minus one and plus or minus I. So the group has 4 to the n plus one elements. What can we say about it? The elements square to one are Hermitian. The elements square to minus one are anti-Hermitian. They're only in there because we need them to make the group closed under multiplication. And all elements either commute or anti-commute. Oh, we can write that. All right. So we're going to be interested in a particular version of the stabilizer formalism that actually picks out a particular state. And this is much like saying, I'm going to pick, well, it's not much like, it is identical to saying, I'm going to pick from that group n commuting observables. And since they commute, they have simultaneous eigenstates. And I'm going to pick the simultaneous plus one eigenstates of those group elements. Those n commuting operators will generate a subgroup of this group that has 2 to the n elements. It's called the stabilizer group. So the next thing we're going to write down is I'm going to be focusing on stabilizer groups that have 2 to the n commuting g's in them. And those commute that group is generated by taking n appropriate members that generate the whole group. Let's see. And then, as I said, once you've got this, you can say that the state psi, that is a simultaneous plus one eigenstate of all these guys, of everything in S, we will call the state stabilized by S. So we could also say we have these generators, n generators that commute. We take the simultaneous plus one eigenstate. Of course, those operators have 2 to the n simultaneous eigenstates, corresponding just to different sequences of eigenvalues plus and minus one for each of the generators. So the way, if we want to get one of those other states, we just put pluses or minuses in front of these guys. We have a different stabilizer, and that stabilizes a different state. So that's the way we get that. Instead of saying that we can consider the 2 to the n states that are simultaneous eigenstates of this set of generators. All right, maybe we should. The next thing I'm doing is just to see what. So you might want to ask, for n qubits, how many states are there like this? Well, it's a tiny fraction of Hilbert space. The number of states that are stabilized by any stabilizer subgroup. Maybe let's not erase it. There's a formula you can write down for it. But the number of states stable grows as 2 to the n squared. So that's a teeny tiny fraction of the number of states in Hilbert space, which grows, roughly speaking, as 2 to the n. And the number of states for different numbers of qubits is 6 for 1, 60 for 2, 1,080 for 3, and I can't remember what it is for 4. 36,720. All right, so how does this help us with this problem I was talking about? Well, what we do, instead of keeping track of the state directly through a circuit like this, is we keep track of how the stabilizer generators change. Oh yeah, I forgot to say one thing. These operations I wrote down, that is H, S, C naught, X, Y, and Z, they preserve the Pauli group. So all that happens when I apply one of those is the stabilizer group just conjugates forward to a new stabilizer group. So instead of keeping track of the state, I just keep track of the end stabilizer generators. Let me give you an example of that. And so that's how the efficient simulation works. So let me just give you an example of that. So let's consider a 3-qubit case. I'm going to draw a quantum circuit. And as I said, I'm going to start in the state 000. First, I'm going to do a Hadamard on the first qubit. Then I'm going to do a controlled knot on the second qubit. And a controlled knot. And then a controlled knot from the first to the third qubit. And this makes the so-called GHZ state. Let's just see how that happens. And then we'll look at the stabilizer description. So after this Hadamard, what's happened is the first qubit has gotten into a superposition of 0 and 1. So that's the state. After this controlled knot, I've made a Bell state on the first two qubits, and after this one, I've made the so-called GHZ state. And let's just see how that works in terms of the stabilizer generators. A convenient set of generators to stabilize this state is just Z's on each qubit, so there's 3 stabilizer generators. When we write things like this, we don't mean multiply those guys together. We implicitly mean there's a tensor product symbol in there, but we got sick of writing it. So that just means Z on the first qubit, I on the second, I on the third. What the Hadamard does on this first one is change the Z to an X, and it does have the effect on the I's. What the controlled knot does is change this xi to xx. So this state looks like this. It changes this iz to a zz. And then what the last one does is change this xi to an xx. And change this iz to a zz. So here's the way the stabilizer generators evolve. If I multiply those guys out, I'll get 8 stabilizer generators. I might do that because there's an important point in it. But you can see, since there are simple rules to go through the gates and evolve the Pauli operators, it doesn't look much simpler here. But once I start getting up to lots of qubits, where there's going to be 2 to the n amplitudes to keep track of, it's going to be a heck of a lot easier to keep track of this list of generators. And it's easy to do. I think it's one of the errors in Nielsen and Chuang. They originally said they did it in order n squared steps, but they were wrong. Their procedure takes order n cubed, and that's what Aronson and Gottesman improved to order n squared. Oh, and I forgot to say one other thing. Measurements. Because we've just been talking about how this thing evolves up until now. If we take any Pauli product, those are the only things we can measure. If that Pauli product is in the stabilizer group, of course, if we measure that Pauli product, we'll get +1. If we take minus one of the elements that's in that group, we'll get -1. And for anything else, we get a random result. So actually, the hardest part of the simulation is simulating a measurement, deciding which of these classes a particular measurement is in, and then and then generating the result. All right. Any questions about this? Because this is all introduction up until now. Ooh, which is good because we only got 20 minutes left. It's all right. So, what am I going to say about this? Well, I want to see how far I can get with local hidden variable theories with these kinds of states. We know we can't do everything. For instance, with the GHC state, there's an immediate contradiction with a local hidden variable theory. But I want to see how far I can get with those local hidden variable theories, provided I allow some classical communication between parties doing the measurements at each qubit that communicates from one party to another what they're measuring. And I should say that our original idea, which turns out not to be entirely correct, but I don't want to explain why, is that that amount of communication was somehow going to be a measure of how entangled these states are. So let's just see how that works. And then we'll apply that to this particular example. So what I want for a state produced by one of those circuits, and hence described by one of these sets of stabilizer generators, is the following kind of table. I want to list the qubits over here. And I want to give you a value for the things that are going to be measured. That is, on each qubit, we can measure either x, y, or z. So I want to have a value for each one. So there's the x, y, and z values for the first qubit down to the x, y, and z values for the last. So first I have to have a way to generate that table. And I think I'll just kind of skip over this and do the do an example. There's kind of two convenient ways to generate this table. One is just to write down the generators as Pauli products and declare all the generators have the value plus 1, which they do. Then there's going to be n other elements that I could pick out of the entire Pauli group that would have random results. I pick some, I pick n, there's lots to pick from. And if I do that, I will determine just by those conditions that the members of the stabilizer generators have value plus 1 and n other elements have random results. I will determine what to put in for the z's, what to put in for the x's. And what I'll find is that there's one bit determined for each, one bit determined per qubit, and one bit left undetermined. And then I'll have to adopt a rule for how to get my y. And so that's motivated by the fact that y is the product of x and z, one way or another. So x, y, z is going to be either plus 1 or minus 1, and I can choose the plus or minus 1 at will. I should say the table depends on the set of generators I've used. I've also got that freedom of a plus and minus 1 for each of the y pieces. But within that freedom, I can make a table. The other way to make a table is simply to start with this circuit and start with a table over here, and then just go through the gates and generate a table for the output state. And when you do that, there's very straightforward rules for what happens at all the single qubit gates. So it's completely obvious what to do. At the C-naughts, or at C-phases, or some other two-qubit gate you might stick in that comes from this set of gates that I introduced, you have to make a choice. And it's when you make that choice that you find you've screwed things up. You can't possibly satisfy all the constraints set by a gate like the C-naught gate. So you make a choice, and you know you'll screw up. And that's what your classical communication is going to have to fix for you in the end. So if we did that with the GHC state, here's the table we'd get. I regret to say that I probably should know that table by heart, but I don't. Oh, so let's say what table we started with over here. What signs did I put in yet? So I put in the z values are plus 1. That's true for this guy. So I put in a random bit for the first q bit. I put in a random bit for x, and then I make my little choice for y. So that's what I start off with. It's convenient for GHC sets to put a minus sign there. So the r's are simply random bits, and the actual hidden variable table, of course, will contain in it either a 0 or a 1. And if I trace through the rules, here's what I get. And so what would this tell me? So this is the kind of table that, for instance, that Merman would want you to write down if you were considering the GHC state. So what do you get wrong if you do this? Well, hope everybody can read this table. So let's have some little practice at it. We get the stabilizer generators right. Oh, I should say, this procedure automatically gets all the random stuff right. It's automatic. Yields a random result. And that just means that after you've multiplied a bunch of these guys out, there's still some random number left in it. It gets all the stabilizer generators right. Let's look at that. XXX means I measure this, 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 multiply those together, you get plus 1. Anything with 2 Z's and an I in it, multiply them together, you get plus 1. And of course, what you don't get right is the other members of the stabilizer group, amongst which are those three guys, which are the heart of Merman's argument, and you get the wrong answer for every one of those, and everybody would have guessed that in advance. Because if I take, let's say, well, it's clear I can't get any negative numbers out of this table, so if I take x, y, y, I get plus 1, and I'm supposed to get minus 1. So how do I fix that? It's trivial to fix it. I wouldn't have had to go through this entire argument to fix it. I simply say, Alice, sitting at the first qubit, finds out from Bob whether Bob measured a y. And if either Alice or Bob measured the y, Alice flips what she gets from her table to the other sign, and that'll get all these guys right. Because the things you need to get right always have either Alice or Bob measuring a y. So you need one bit of communication to do that. We could elaborate this. And this is the thing that I'm absolutely confident about, because this would have done in detail. You just elaborate this by making a n qubit GHC state, and that just means sticking more controlled knots on here. You get a superposition of 0, 0, 0 for all the qubits plus 1, 1, 1 for all the qubits. And you generate one of these tables. And for this table to get things right, you need n minus 2 bits of n minus 2 bits of communication. Everybody except the last guy has to communicate to Alice whether he measured a y. If Alice measured an x or y, Alice counts up the number of y's and flips. Oh, I realize I said that slightly. This first, because Alice collects from everybody else whether they measured a y. And if she measured an x or a y, she flips if the number of y's is even but not a multiple of 4. And you can slightly improve that because the last y she doesn't need. She'll make some flips in random cases which don't have any effect. So you need n minus 2 bits of communication to get the GHC states right. And that's provably optimal using a kind of generalization of Merman's argument. So this is an example of what I want to do. Worked out completely for GHC states. I have a table, which is a local hidden variable theory. It doesn't work, but a certain amount of communication, in this case known to be optimal, will make it work. So let's see, what should I do next? All right, so we don't have a lot of time, so I'll just tell you what we know about the general case. And then there's a particular connection that I want to draw here, actually just because I'm here. So what can we say about general stabilizer states? So I'm going to go through this pretty fast, and if you think this is just a pitch, well, I'm real confident in nearly everything I'm saying. So all stabilizer states can be converted by, and I guess only the experts will understand this, so if you're not an expert, wait a second, and then we'll get back to something you will understand. All stabilizer states can be converted by H's and S's to graph states. And for graph states, we can work all this out. We have a hidden variable model, which, working with graph states, the hidden variable model isn't trivial. You can easily see how to write it down. And of course, it's wrong in general. But we have a protocol that fixes everything, except it doesn't quite fix everything. It gets all of the, no matter what measurement is being made, if you multiply together all the results of everybody, that everybody gets from their table with the corrections they've made after the communication. You get that right, but you don't get all the subcorrelations right, and we haven't quite figured that out yet. We do know how to do it for graph states that are rings or graph states that are lines, but of course those are the most trivial cases. So we have a long way to go. So in my remaining time, instead of telling you about that, what I'm going to do is draw a connection between this way of looking things and Speckin's toy model by looking at one qubit and then kind of looking at two qubits in a slightly more perfunctory way. So this whole thing simplifies to something very easy for one qubit. What are the possible stabilizer generators for one qubit? Well, there's X, Y, and Z, and there's the negative of each one of them. The stabilizer group in this case is the identity operator and that generator, and that's of course true for all of them because these are very simple groups. So let's start filling in what state is stabilized by these guys. I'm already in the two qubit case. The state stabilized by Z is the zero state, and the state stabilized by minus Z is the one state. The state stabilized by X is the state that's usually labeled plus. That's the equal combination of zero and one with a plus in between. State stabilized by minus X is the state usually labeled minus. And then the state stabilized by Y is the state often called I, which is 1 over root 2, 0 plus I, 1. And the state that's stabilized by minus Y is the state then labeled by minus I. So these are other linear superpositions of 0 and 1. Of course, they're just the eigenstates of X, Y, and Z. So now, what table do we write down for these guys? As I said, the tables are pretty easy to write down. But there's that one little choice, and so I'll look at my notes to make sure I make the same choice I usually make. We're going to make a three-column table. Z is 1 for this state. X is random, and then we're going to choose the minus R convention for Y. So X is random, Y is random. If you could measure X and Y, you'd find they had an anticorrelation. Of course, you can't do that, so the anticorrelation doesn't make a difference. Z is 1. And then you just go through and fill all these guys in, because you can get from that state to all the rest using rotations about the various axes, and so you don't have to do any work to generate. You generate tables that are consistent with the original one, and let me just write them down. Uh, I'll put those in little boxes so you can see them. And then for minus z, we'll get minus 1. What did I do? RR. For minus x, you get minus 1 minus RR. And for y, minus y, you get r minus 1 r. So those are the very simple tables you get from this. And of course, there's not any question of classical communication here. You just get everything right. There's nothing to communicate with. And these are the six epistemic states in Speckin's toy model. And you can generate the epistemic states in the following way. Speckin has four ontic states, and the epistemic states corresponding to knowing one bit about those four ontic states. So two of them are left undetermined. So a state is specified by coloring in two of them, which are the two you don't, corresponding to the bit you don't know. And this is the way you fill in the table from these guys over here. You write x and z, and the ontic state corresponding to the first box is x equal 1, z equal 1. For the second box, it's minus 1, 1. It's for the third box, it's 1, minus 1. And then the fourth box kind of got screwed there. It's minus 1. And if you just go through and take these values, you'll fill in nearly the same coloring that Speckin's has. Because of the way I chose my convention for y equal xz, I think these two states have the reverse coloring from what Speckin's chooses. So what does that tell you? That tells you when you elaborate all this to n qubits, you're, whereas I approached it as I'm elaborating the stabilizer formalism, I could also equally well say I'm elaborating Speckin's toy model to n qubits, so that these stabilizer states are the allowed epistemic states in Speckin's toy model, and the values I assign to in my local hidden variable table are the ontic states, that is the actual values of something. It's the only difference is that here I'm actually attaching those real values, those local hidden variables, to particular qubits and to particular measurements on that those qubits, that is x or z measurements on those qubits. So for example, we can go through generalizing this to two qubits, where there are 36 states that are products of these, and then there's 24 entangled states, and those 24 entangled states correspond to the 24 possible stabilizer generator sets that you can pick, or actually the 24 possible stabilizer groups you can pick. And if you just elaborate this, work out what happens for two qubits, use this little way to translate these ontic values into Speckin's ontic values, you'll find the same kind of little 4x4 boxes that describe the epistemic states as you'll find in Rob's paper. So I'm saying that here because Rob's in the audience, and also because you could say that what I'm trying to do for bigger collections of qubits is to take his toy model and ask how much non-locality, as measured by the communication I need to make it work, how much non-locality do I need to actually relate the ontic states and their the ontic states to things that agree with quantum mechanics. With two qubits, you don't need any. Get it all right. With bigger numbers of qubits, you'll need a certain amount of communication. Let's see. You might have noticed that I didn't say how much communication was needed in general. And that's because for all of those graph states, although we do have a protocol that, as I said, nearly works, in the end, there's not a lot of difference between a protocol that nearly works and one that doesn't work at all. So there's very little point in reporting how much communication is required to make that work. So I didn't. But we hope to get them working. And then, of course, what you'd really like to know is not what amount of communication, you know, some people sitting off there in Albuquerque with their heads fried by the sun, what amount of communication they think is necessary. Rather, you'd like to know, did you make up a protocol that's provably optimal? That's the thing we can prove for GHC states. Our protocol, which is more or less completely obvious, is optimal. And we don't know how to do that for general states, that is for all the graph states. But we're working on that. All right, thank you. How should I respond to that? I did assume. So the philosophy here is very much the philosophy of Merman's argument, GHC argument. That is, you actually think of each qubit as carrying with it values of x, y, and z. And the r's simply mean that we don't know that result, but of course the qubit does. So I think your question is, what if I did something, or your question might be, or I'm going to interpret your question to be, what if we did something more general? So I'm going to admit that, I'd like to admit mistakes, as you can see. So I'm going to admit we made a terrible mistake in thinking about what we were doing when we were doing this. We thought that the amount of communication would somehow be a measure of the fact that we could do this with a linear amount of communication, and I'm pretty confident we can do that for all graph states. Maybe a quadratic amount of communication, but I hope it will be linear. If we can do that, then our original idea was, well, that's going to be the thing that tells us that these states, although they're globally entangled, they're not really very entangled, since all you need to fix up a local hidden variable model is a linear amount of communication. But you know, this is one of the advantages of submitting papers and getting referee reports, is that you can do the following, which I will freely admit was pointed out to us by a referee. They're not always wrong. It just seems that way. So you can do the following. You could do a simulation of any quantum evolution by having one special qubit, and that special qubit has sitting at it a classical computer that just does a classical simulation of the evolution of the wave function. The hidden variables are then the whole wave function. So classical communication is required for all the parties to send in what operation they're currently doing on their qubits. And then after you're finished, classical communication is required. Well, the special qubit person actually looks at the wave function, manufactures some coins that produce measurement results. Oh, all the guys have to say what they're measuring, whatever that is. The special guy simply manufactures some coins that are weighted in just the right way according to the wave function to produce the right probability, flips them and sends the results out to everybody. And that's it turns out that's a tiny, well, it's a linear amount of communication. So you can do anything that way. Well, you could make up a rule. That's ridiculous. That's not local. Somebody who has nothing to do with the operations that are being done has to do a lot of updating. Well, you just have everybody do a complete simulation of quantum mechanics. And then all the qubits are equivalent. So if we're going to make any sense of this, we are eventually going to have to get to the point where we ask how much information is stored at each qubit. Because we have a really small amount of information stored at each qubit. We have 2 bits stored at each qubit. Whereas in the simulation of the whole wave function, you've got a heck of a lot of information stored there. So if we're going to make sense of it, it's not going to be the classical communication that's going to be so important. It's going to be how much information is stored at each qubit to make the hidden variable model work. And we know that. We just don't draw attention to it, except, well, here I can draw attention to it. And that might have something to do with your question, because that's going to be the thing that would distinguish us from some simulation that kept track of the entire wave function. Probably enough, but I wanted to say it anyway. Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that Hans has done a huge amount of work on kind of general, the general versions of Bell inequalities for stabilizer states. So that's probably why he's among the reasons why he's interested. Up to H's and S's, and that's the reason. Well, sorry, we know we can do that. So what does that buy us? Well, that buys us that it is very easy to generate the table. All the z's are random. All the z's are random. And the x's, you can just look at the stabilizer generators and figure out what to put in the x column. And the y's, then you just make your choice, y's plus or minus x. So that's trivial. Plus, it's very easy to analyze the measurements. You give me a measurement. I figure out where the x's and y's are in the measurement. I just look at that, and I can tell whether that measurement is in the stabilizer group or not just by looking at that graph. And I can very easily tell when I need to make a sign flip to get the right answer from my table. So that's the reason. And we know how to make it come out right. We just don't know how to make all the sub-correlations come out right. Since you've asked, I'll tell you what we... Well, this is why we have questions. So the speaker can do whatever he wants. Is that six? Yeah. So let's say we have a graph state that looks like that. And let's say I make this measurement. That measurement is in the stabilizer, so it has the result plus one. Our protocol to get things right actually has each party flipping result they get from their table, but since there's flips, six flips, you still get it right. The problem is that if you divide that into two parts like this, anyway, every other qubit's on one side or the other. So those are also stabilizer generators, so and they should also be plus one. And our protocol gives you minus one because we did some flips that you shouldn't have done. That's easy to fix, actually, but we don't know how to fix that kind of mistake in general. I think we have to know more about graph theory. That's right. Absolutely right. Yeah, we already know how to do that. Yeah, that's the thing. Oh, and God, I forgot to mention my collaborators. So all the work on GHC states was done by Ivan Deutsch, Tracy Tessier, Dave Bacon, and Brian Easton, all of whom, except Dave Bacon worked at UNM, Dave was at the Santa Fe Institute. And I'm currently working on this with Brian Easton and Matt, oh God, it's terrible when you can't remember your students' names, Matt Elliott, who's also at UNM. And it's Matt who's figured out the way to make, well, he figured out how to get all two colorable, and he's figured out this protocol that nearly works, which, as I said, is no better than not working at all. Recommend this hat. Maybe I should lend it out for the rest of the conference. You know, I didn't have any problem with those lights. The one time I took it off, it's pretty bad. I mean, Howard was up there. You know, and it looks like you're an explorer off on a, you know, out in the Wild West. Where are they out there?
my question was, I was heading towards somewhere else, because you, when you started describing these stabilizer state, you mentioned, you know, how rapidly they grow, like 2 to the n of the food.